We're doing Parshat Shemot, and as usual, we'll try to do a quick overview of the Parsha before we go in depth. Our Parsha is really the beginning of Sefer Shemot, the book of Shemot, and so let's just get a quick overview. The book is going to take us from the Jews being in Egypt and forced labor as slaves, through the 10 plagues, through the Exodus, and then the Jews receiving the man, and the miracles of the desert, the clouds that surrounded them, and up to the Jews coming to Mount Sinai, receiving the Torah, the erection of the tabernacle, the building of the Mishkan, and the mitzvot of Kohanim. We'll also have, in the interim, the Ten Commandments, and we'll have the mitzvot of Eila Mishpatim, the monetary laws that we have to fulfill. And then we will conclude with the actual building, Vayakel Pikudei, the actual building and the counting of the Jewish people, the actual building of the tabernacle and the counting. Our parsha takes us from the passing of the 12 tribes to Moshe Rabbeinu. We learn about Moshe as being born, being placed in the casket, being found by the daughter of Pharaoh, and then Moshe's rescuing a Jew. He has to run out to Midian after he killed an Egyptian to save a Jew's life, and then other Jews threatened to tell Paro what he did, so he runs away, and he marries the priest's daughter, he marries Yisro's daughter, Tzipora. He has a child named Gershom. Moshe has an appearance. God appears to him in a burning bush, and God tells him he should go and save the Jews from Egypt. Moshe refuses. He spends a week arguing, and God tells him, bottom line, go, gather the elders, and God gives him three signs to show them. And ultimately, God says they will come out with great wealth, but it ain't going to be easy. I know that Paro won't want to listen, and it'll take time. So Moshe Rabbeinu goes back to Yisro, and he asks his permission to go. He takes his wife and two children. And when they're en route, so Moshe is almost killed. And Tzipora recognizes that it is because they have detained circumcising their second child. So she circumcises the child. And then Aaron comes to greet them. Aaron tells Moshe, what are you bringing your wife and kids here? We're so sad that we're stuck here. What are you bringing more people to be stuck here? So Moshe sends her back home to her father's house to wait it out. And she's going to wait a year and a half until she comes to the desert when the Jews are by Sinai. Moshe and Aaron come to Paro. Paro says, I don't know this God you're talking about. And then he says, must be the Jews have too much time on their hand if they're thinking about going on vacation and bringing sacrifices. So they start beating the nation more and raising the quota that they have to deliver. And the soldiers, the policemen, the Jewish policemen, were being beaten, and they meet up with Moshe and Aaron, who are not part of the forced labor, and they fight with them. And Moshe turns to Hashem and he says, "Why have you hurt the nation so? Why'd you send me? Ever since I've come, it's only got worse." And God tells Moshe, wait, now you're going to see what I will do. With a strong hand, he will send them and chase them out of his land. And now let's begin and try to see more depth. Our parsha begins, Ve'ele Shemot. These are the names of the Jewish people who came to Mitzrayim. It's interesting that the whole book is called the Book of Shemot, the Book of Names. We don't have time to go in depth what this concept teaches us about names and the importance of names. We know that one of the things the Jewish people had in their favor, one of their merits, was that they maintained their names, their Jewish names. They weren't called Christopher. They were called Aaron, Miriam, Yosef. Okay. And the Torah tells us that The Parsha of Shmos is the second book of the Torah, but it's directly connected to the first book. And that's why the Parsha in the book of Shmos begins with a Vav. Ve'eile Shmos, and these are the names of the Jewish people, who the sons of Israel came down to Mitzrayim, to show us right away we're connected. This isn't a new thing, this is a connection. When the Jewish people come down to Mitzrayim, so the Pasuk stresses, Ishu Beito Bau. Yaakov ensured that they were all married. He made Sheduchim even for his great-grandchildren, even the little ones knew, this was the one I was going to marry. Now ordinarily, we don't make forced marriages. We say, wait till a kid is old enough to know who they want to marry and then set him up. We don't marry off kids when they're too young to know what they're talking about. But Yaakov knew that in Mitzrayim, the temptations would be too great. So Yaakov knew that he has to forgo that, and he has to set up Shiduchim as best as he can. So if you want to be very spiritual, you could say Yad Ruach HaKodesh. But the simple look at this is that he did like that that Roman woman did. He took one child and matched him with one girl, and took another child and matched him with another girl, and we know that when that Roman woman did it, it didn't work. But there is an aspect where it could work. We always look for the best fit. But we also have to know that it's up to us to make a marriage work, and it could work. And Yaakov knew what he was doing wasn't ideal, but he knew it was the lesser of two evils. There are certain situations where a person is far stronger when he has to contend with those situations as a married person. People mistake this concept. They think, if I'm married, I could see dirty movies. They tell their kids, I'm married, it's okay. That's wrong. Same prohibition exists if you're married or not. But on the other hand, Chazal do say, pat bisalo, if a person has bread in his basket, he's not as hungry. When you know you could eat, at the end of the fast, suddenly you're not as hungry as you were an hour ago when you couldn't eat. But you've been fasting an hour longer, but now it's the end of Yom Kippur, and I can take my time going down to the lunchroom. Once I have the food before me, if someone comes to talk to me, another minute doesn't make a big difference. You're standing an hour before the end of Yom Kippur, sometimes you feel like you're not going to make it. Chazal tells there's a concept of pat bisalo. You have bread in your basket, so you're less hungry. By the same token, when a person's married, so there is an aspect where he can control his desire better. And Yaakov knew the temptations of promiscuity that were rampant throughout Egypt. So he wanted to ensure that his children had better odds standing up to this temptation. And we see it work. The Jews were faithful in their marriages. Chazal make a point of telling us that even though the Egyptians were beating them, we find one guy is recorded as having an Egyptian father. Our sages say the Torah points out this one guy to tell us he was the exception. His mother was immodest. She was friendly with the Egyptians. She was friendly with everyone. She was always telling everyone, hi, how are you? And one thing led to another. Yeah. I don't know, but it would seem that his fear was for the men. We're always the more problematic one, us men. I hear. It's a good point. Notice that the Jews started off in Egypt as part of the upper class. When they came down, they were white men in black men's territory. And they were nobles, they were wealthy, and they didn't believe in the Egyptian god. They were shepherds while the Egyptians were worshipping the sheep. And they owned their own territory. They lived in the land of Goshen, which that real estate belonged to them, whereas the rest of the Egyptian lived on property that belonged to Paro. So they started off being on the top of the social strata, and they devolved in 210 years to the bottom. But this took time. There was a new dynasty, Vayakom El Chadash Al Mitzrayim. A new dynasty began in Egypt, and they decided they want to demote the Jews. And they recognized that there was also a demographical problem. If the Jews, we have on tradition, were giving birth to six at a time, so you figure if a woman gives birth, let's say, five times in her life, four times in her life, the average Jewish family was over somewhere between 20 and 30 kids. So figure there are 70 people multiply, let's say 70 people, they all get married, so 70 times 20, so you're already holding by 1,400, one generation. Multiply that by 20, and you're already holding by 28,000, right? Multiply that by 20, and that's assuming they only had 20, assuming they only gave birth four times, right? Multiply that by 20, and we're already holding by, we said 28, so four generations later, and we're already holding by 500,000 Jews. Multiply that by 20, and we're holding by 2 million, the amount of Jews that left Egypt. So that's, the Jews were growing at a disproportionate rate, and they were concerned. So they say we have to outsmart them. We have to outsmart them. They were worried that the Jews wouldn't be faithful. So what do? They tell the Jews, you guys are loyal citizens. We're starting a project. All citizens participate. And by touching that point, are you faithful citizens? Look, every good Egyptian is participating in this project. They get the Jews to participate. Throughout our history, that's been a weak point. We always felt like we have to prove ourselves that we're faithful citizens. You see it over here too. When the Egyptians touched that point, they said, everyone's working. Come on, even Pharaoh's working. So slowly they were able to get the Jews into this forced workforce, and ultimately the Jews became slaves. The first day everyone was working, the next day they were officers, and slowly it evolved into a situation where they were forced to work and they were policemen, and the Egyptians were not working. Who wasn't in this forced labor? The tribe of Levi. Tribe of Levi said, I don't know what you're talking about. My job is in the Beis Medrash. I'm the head of the academy. You know, you guys have your priests, we're our priests. Our job here is to learn Torah. Sometimes when a person nips it at the bud and says, I'm not interested in other things. I'm here in Beis Medrash. I'm learning. He'll find himself out of trouble. In the long run, things evolve. So Paro is looking to outsmart the Jews, and he invites three advisors, Eov, Bilam, and Yisroel. Now, if this plot took place, we'll assume 70 years before the redemption, 100 years before the redemption. We know we were in Egypt 210 years. And we know that Yosef passed away at what age? How old was Yosef? 100 and something, right? 110. So Yosef was 110. And the Jews came down to Egypt when Yosef was almost 40, right? He was 39. So until Yosef died, everything was okay. Until his whole generation died, everything was okay. So you figure we had at least 70 years where everything was okay. Probably a little bit more than that. Let's say 100 years where everything was okay. So it was approximately 110 years when things were troublesome. Only the last 110 years. Now, who was in on this plot? Chazal tell us it was Bilam, Yisroel, and Eov. Bilam said, this is what you got to do. Eov was silent, and that's why Job suffered. And Yisroel said, no way, you shouldn't do this, and he ran away, and that's why he became Jewish ultimately. He joined us. The only problem is that we have on tradition that Bilam died at age 33. Now, if Bilam was 33 years old when we were 40 years in the desert, that means that Bilam wasn't yet born when we were still in Mitzrayim. Bilam was only born when we were 7 years into the desert. Right? Because at the end of our stay in the desert, at the 40th year, the whole story of Bilam happens and Bilam gets killed. So Bilam wasn't yet born. That's the problem. So it must be that when we speak about Bilam over here, we're talking about Bilam the grandfather. Bilam had a grandfather whose grandfather was Lavan. We know Bilam was a direct descendant of Lavan. So if we say Bilam is Lavan and Lavan just lived a beautiful long life, he lived a good approximately 400 years, so then everything works. You make people have longevity, then everything works. But if we go with Pshat and we go with our tradition that Bilam was all of 33, so then here we're not talking about that Bilam, we're talking about a grandfather Bilam who was a grandson of Lavan. So they tax them, and that it's just taxes, and through taxes they take their wealth. They take their control of self because they make them work. Now, their bodies are owned by the Egyptians, and they make their lives bitter by making the work as difficult as possible. They tell them, you guys dig in our field, you guys take out the trash. They knock them down as much as possible. And because they tried to knock down their wealth, so God ultimately destroys the wealth of the Egyptians with the beginning of the plagues. The Nile turns to blood, you have locusts devouring their crops, their cattle dies. By the time the Jews leave, the Egyptians' wealth is finished. Because the Egyptians were beating the Jews, they were beating their bodies, they were beating them physically, so God sends plagues against their body. We have lice, we have boils. The Egyptians were punished in their bodies. And then because they caused the death of many Jews, ultimately the Egyptians themselves died. We have the firstborns. We have many people dying throughout Mitzrayim. So our parasha is setting the stage. It's telling us, what did the Egyptians really do? How they made us suffer, and how they purposely did it. They were planning and planning. Pharaoh sees with the stargazers that there's going to be a boy who's going to save the Jews. So that's a problem. So Pharaoh has a decree that the male children have to be thrown into the Nile. And here we see the first suicide bombers, because they not only killed the Jewish male children, they killed the Egyptian male children, because the stargazers told Pharaoh, we see in the stars that this kid is going to grow up in an Egyptian home. We can't tell if he's Jewish or Egyptian. So that day, they say, today he was born. So they take all the children, they tell the Egyptians, look, it's for your own good. We're only taking one child, but we'll end up having the Jews as slaves for the future. And that's how they convince them, and they throw the kids into the Nile. Now, we have to explore a little bit why they kill them in this fashion, throwing them into the Nile. We know they served the Nile. Now, was this a way of sending the kids to their god? I didn't see anyone discuss that. Now, they thought... Huh? Both. Many of the Zara in Mitzrayim. They served the sheep, they served the Nile, they served Pharaoh. They had many of the Zara. They had Baal Tzifon. They had many idols. So the Egyptians think we'll make them work so hard they won't have strength to go home, and this way they won't have children. What happens? The Jewish women come out to their field to their husbands, and they bring them pitchers filled with water. And Hashem makes it that when they fill up the pitchers with water, fish, little fish go into the water. And little fish are things that Chazal say are good for pru or vu. They're good fertility medicine. So they'd bring them these pitchers filled with water, and they'd cook them a fish soup over there outside in the field. And then they'd bring these little mirrors with them, and they'd entice their husbands. They'd start looking in the mirror and they'd say, who's better looking, me or you? And the husband would say, I don't have any strength. Come on, I've worked my head off today. I don't even have strength to come home. I'm out here in the field, I'm going to sleep. And the women were smart. They figured out how to arouse them. Tachat ha-tapuach, under the esrog trees, orarticha, I've aroused you. That's a praise of the Jewish women. Thanks to them, the Jewish people continued. The men, their tendency is to be short-sighted. Right now he doesn't have koach. Right now he's wiped. So catch me later. The wife, she says, no, we need a future. No, she comes out to the field. And the women, as always, much stronger than the men, even though they're also in part of the forced labor, they come out to the field and they find the strength to put up these flasks, these pots filled with water and fish, and they cook them for the husbands, and they arouse them, and they find a modest place where each field, when it would end, so they'd always make the end of the field go up a little bit. There would be a slight raise in the earth so that you could recognize where the end of your field, where your field ended. If you're plowing the field, it also makes sense, so you keep pushing the earth towards the end of the field. So always at the end of the field, the fields would go up a little bit. And between two fields, you had a little bit of space. And in that space, they'd sleep with their husbands and whatever modesty they could find over there. But they recognized they had no choice, and they're praised for that. Later on, they're going to want to donate those mirrors for the Mishkan, And Moshe is going to look at those mirrors and say, what are you doing with mirrors? You make yourself more beautiful to entice men. I don't bring this into the service of Hashem. And God says, no, I love those mirrors. Those mirrors are the source of the future of the Jewish people. Thanks to those mirrors, there are Jews around. So we have to know that beauty is also something. It's a weapon, it's a tool, and when used properly, it's praiseworthy. Under the tapuach. Okay. Over there, I guess they started arousing them. Over there, they'd give them the meal. Over there, they'd sweet talk them. The midwives stand up to Paro, and as payback, Hashem says, Vayas. Yeah. I don't know, maybe. I don't know how they plowed. That's what you're saying, fine.
You can't believe that all through the plowing, they're carrying. You gotta drop it off at the turn.
I hear. I don't know. I've never plowed. Whatever I'll tell you is theory, so I have no idea. So, Paro turns to the midwives, and the midwives tell him, the Jewish women, chayotena, just like animals don't need midwives, they manage alone. Chayotena, they themselves are midwives. You think they call us? They turn to their neighbor. They don't have time to call from the other end of Egypt. They turn to their neighbor, and their neighbor helps them out. They don't need us. So the midwives give excuses. In life, sometimes you have to know to give excuses. People sometimes think, if you're a God-fearing person, then you'll say, no, this is murder, I'm not going to do it, no way. We don't see that that's what happened. You see that they gave excuses. They said, we're not there anyways, they manage without us. An intelligent person doesn't always take things head on. And as payback, Vayas lahim batim, God made them the homes of Kehuna, Levius, and Malchus, that the leaders of the Jewish people, be it the leaders in the temple, be it the leaders, the kings, came from these fine women. And the reason it's called Bayis is because Bayis means something that has permanence. Something that's steadfast. So Hashem made them batim. He gave them the batim, kunan v'yal malchut, in permanence, and it remained in their family. The man goes and marries a woman. She's 130 years old, and they have a child. And the man we know is Amram. Over here the Torah doesn't tell us his name. The Torah stresses that he was an ish. He was a man. He was the man of the hour. There was a decree that they're going to murder the Jewish children. And the men didn't have strength or an interest at that time to marry or build families. They were wiped. And along comes one person and he stands up and he changes the tide. He says, no, I'm getting married. And he makes a wedding. And everyone hears about it. He's the leader of the Jewish people. So the Torah doesn't stress the fact that he's Amram. The Torah stresses the fact that he was an ish. He was the man. B'makom she'en anashim, where there are no men, ishtadel yot ish, a person has to force himself to practice as though he were a man. Fake it if you have to, but be a man. Now, Chazal tell us that he had divorced her, and his daughter had told him, if you divorce her, then there'll be no more children. And that's worse than Pharaoh's decree, and he accepted what she said, and he remarried her. So, Vayikach et bat Levi, he remarried her. Now this brings us to an interesting concept. The Torah tells us that a Noahide is supposed to marry a woman. A Noahide is, that's the normal way of life that the Torah expects him to do. And stick to her. Be faithful to her, she be faithful to him. And the question is there a concept of a widow, of a divorcee, for Noahites? So we see that the Medrash tells us that there is a concept of divorce, because the Torah wasn't yet given, so all the Jews in Egypt were still Noahites, and the Torah tells us that this man divorced his wife, and then he remarried her. So we see there is a concept of divorce for Noahites as well. You could say that, but that wouldn't permit him to divorce his wife if by Noahide laws he could not. Correct. Possibly. Because the Torah doesn't tell us they have this option of divorce. Yes. Now, the Pasuk tells us something strange. The Pasuk tells us she saw that he was good, so she hid him. And what if he wouldn't have been good? She wouldn't have hid him? So Moshe, we have on tradition, was born prematurely. And we're also told that the Egyptians said anyone who is caught hiding their baby will get killed. So the question is, halachically, what were they supposed to do? Were they supposed to hide the baby at home and risk their own lives? Especially when this baby is born prematurely. And in those days, they didn't have ventilation machines. They couldn't do CPR. They couldn't bring the kid. They couldn't give him the Heimlich maneuver or CPR, give him breaths. So you have a premature baby. He's born 3 months prematurely. And, okay, fine. Go ask doctors today how fine that is. My son was born 6 weeks prematurely, and thanks to modern medicine, he's still here. But he had things which, I mean, for modern medicine, it's simple. You just put him on a breathing machine until his lungs are strong enough. You just give him a chemical that helps the lungs become ripe. There are all kinds of things they do today. That's very nice. And then they send the kid home, and they say, no problem. But, you know, I don't know 100 years ago if babies like that survived. No, that's what the Pasuk stresses. She saw him kitovu. She saw that he was good. She saw that even though he was born prematurely, this baby's fine. And so she hid him. And they risked their lives over this baby. And when they realized they couldn't hide him anymore, so now it was equivalent to suicide if they'd leave him at home. So they took him and they put him in the reeds of the Yamsuf or the Nile, different opinions. And that day was 6 days into the month of Sivan, when he was 3 months old. And in heaven, the angels approached God and said, today he's supposed to give the Torah. 81 years from now, on this day, he's supposed to receive the Torah and give it to the Jewish people. So on that day, Hashem made it that in the heavens the stargazers saw that the leader of the Jewish people was hit by water. He was put in the water. And they stopped the decree. And that's why Moshe Rabbeinu later on tells the Jewish people, you owe it all to me, guys. When I hit the water, they stopped the decree. There's a time when Moshe Rabbeinu says that to them. Paro is ill. He has tzaras. He has leprosy. And his daughter also has this problem. So she goes down to the Nile to wash. Chazal gave us tradition that she decided that these pagan ways are ridiculous, and she decided to convert to Judaism, to monotheism. So she went down to the Nile to immerse in the waters as a mikveh. She wanted to become Jewish. And she goes down to the Nile, and she sees the casket. She pulls out the casket, takes out the baby. The baby's taken out of the casket. What do many babies do when you unwrap them? Anyone who's been to a mila, they wet their diaper. So she unwraps Moshe, picks him up and looks at him. Oh, what a cute baby! And so he spritzes her. He gets her all wet. He urinates on her. And we have on tradition that when he urinated on her, he cured her from her leprosy. And she looks and she says, wow, I'm cured. So she has a special affinity for this baby. She wants to nurse the baby. And, yeah.
So after functioning the baby, are three Jewish women watching Jews?
But what was she supposed to do? There were no Jews yet.
There were three Jewish women, certainly.
Nope, there were no Jews. Avram wasn't Jewish. Moshe wasn't Jewish. So whatever gerus they had in that time, she did.
Well, yeah.
I don't know. Geirus begins with Matan Torah. There was some concept of Geirus which she performed to accept monotheism on herself. We say when a person is Chozer B'tshuva, let's say a person decides that he's leaving a Jewish lifestyle. He was Jewish and he decides he's going to stop observing Torah. And then he decides he's going to join another religion. And then he realizes his mistakes, he comes back and says, I want to come back. So our tradition is that we make him go back to mikveh. He's Jewish. He was always Jewish. But part of the tshuva process, part of the process of coming back, is that we tell the guy, go to mikveh.
What was the difference between Pharaoh's daughter and
Jew? It's a good question. I don't know. So, Yocheved, who was all of 2.5 at that time, she runs up and says, you want me to call you a Jewish woman to nurse the baby? And she says, yes. And so they call his mother, Yocheved, this 130-year-old woman who for some reason could nurse. And she says, Batya tells her, you nurse and I'll pay your wages. She takes the baby, which is really her own son, and as the baby is old enough, she brings him to Batya, and she brings him up, and she calls him Moshe. She says, I drew you out of the water, so I'm calling you Moshe, the one who drew us. Yes?
Why is it a surprise that she was able to nurse?
I don't know. Most women can't conceive past the age of 45, 50, let alone nurse. Okay. I'm just saying, if you were Batya and a 130-year-old woman came over and said, I'll nurse the baby for you, then I think what you tell her is, I think I'll find a younger nurse. That's what I would say. If I were looking for a wet nurse, my first choice would not be a woman who's 130 years old. So Chazal say that she didn't look 130. That not only was she able to conceive, but she also didn't look her age. Moshe grows up, and Paro appoints him head of the house, and Moshe goes out to see the suffering of his brethren. Who's been bringing him up? A woman who accepted monotheism. And she knows he's Jewish, and it's reasonable to think that she has no interest in hiding that from him. So Moshe grows up and he says, let me go out and see my brethren suffering. Rashi says, Natan einav velibo liyot meitzer aleihem. He took note, he looked, he gave his heart to feel for them. So we see that Moshe worked on himself. Meaning a person could sit here and say, yeah, it's terrible that there are bombs falling in the south, and then take a bite from a sandwich and go on with life. But a great person works on himself to feel other people's pain. Moshe Rabbeinu says, let me go out so that I will feel it, because when I'm sitting in the palace, I won't feel it. Moshe encounters the following scene. There was an Egyptian man, and there was this young Jewish girl named Shlomis Bas Divri, who was married to Dasan. And Shlomis Bas Divri was a girl who was friendly with everyone, and too friendly. So she was friendly with the Egyptians and friendly with the Jews and always telling everyone hi. And so this Egyptian was interested in her. So he came in the middle of the night and he pulls Dasan out of bed and he tells him, you got to go to work. So Dasan doesn't have strength and his wife doesn't have strength. And the Egyptian takes him out into the field and tells him, now start working. So the Jew starts working. Dasan is out in the field working. The Egyptian sneaks back to the home and goes into bed with Dasan's wife, with Shlomis Bas Divri. She's half asleep and she has no clue that it's not her husband. The Egyptian leaves the home and bumps into Dasan, who's on his way back home. He's been working through the night. Dasan understands what's happened, and the Egyptian sees that Dasan's figured out what's happened. So the Egyptian starts beating Dasan, and he doesn't plan on stopping. His intent is to beat him to death. And this is the first scene that Moshe encounters when he comes out of the palace. He's come out of the palace to see his brethren, and he sees this Egyptian beating the Jew to death, literally. So Moshe takes a look at the Egyptian, and with Ruach HaKodesh he sees that there's no future. None of his offsprings are going to do something worthwhile. So Moshe says God's hidden name, and the Egyptian drops dead. Moshe takes the Egyptian and buries him. He buries him in the sand. The next day, again, Moshe goes out to see what's happening. And he meets the same Dasan, he just saved his life, fighting with Aviram, his brother. So these two brothers, the sons of On, these two brothers are fighting, and Moshe sees Dasan picking up his hand to hit his brother Aviram. Moshe says, "You're going to hit him? You're Russia. What's with you?" And Dasan turns to him and says, "Who appointed you leader over here? Are you going to kill me like you killed that Egyptian? I'm going to go tell Paro." So Moshe looks at the man. He just saved his life. And this man is telling him he's going to go tell Paro that he killed the Egyptian. So Moshe says, "Now I understand. I always wondered, why is it that this nation is suffering more than any other nation? But if this nation can speak badly about people, then I understand why they've gotten this decree." Chazal tell us that Moshe buried him in the sand. That's a reference to the fact that there were only Jews around. And after he killed the Egyptian, he turned to his brethren and said, "Now this is our secret. No one has to know about this. I'm burying this amongst us." And when the next day two Jews are fighting and one tells him, "Are you going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian? I'm going to go tell Paro." Then Moshe says, "I helped you guys. This is the payback you're giving me." The first level of prophecy is that a person cannot stand seeing things that are wrong. When he sees people being wrongly persecuted and wrongly hurt, he stands up to help them out. That feeling, "I have to help the oppressed," that feeling is what's called Ruach Hashem. The Spirit of Hashem is upon the person. That's why Moshe, who is moving up in the ladder of prophecy, when he sees the Egyptian beating the Jew, he stands up and saves him. He walks out the next day and he sees one Jew beating another Jew, he interferes. And this shows us the balance. It wasn't just the fact that it was an Egyptian hitting a Jew. The next day when he sees a Jew hitting a Jew, he also interferes. And a short while later when he comes to Midian and he sees the shepherds fighting with girls, he also interferes. The issue is, he is on his way to being a prophet, he has refined traits, and when he sees something wrong, he stands there and tries to rectify it. Paro hears that Moshe killed an Egyptian to save a Jew. And Paro wants to kill Moshe. Now, Paro and Moshe have an old relationship. When Moshe was still a baby and Batya adopted him, so Paro's advisors told him, "Don't bring this boy into your home." And then Paro was playing around with Moshe the baby, and Moshe took his crown off his head and put it on his own head. and Pharaoh's sorcerers and advisors said, this is a sign, he's going to take the throne from you. You have to get rid of this baby. And Pharaoh said, okay, we'll make a test. Yes. I don't know if Pharaoh knew that his daughter adopted monotheism, and I don't know if Pharaoh knew that Moshe was a Jewish baby.
So
I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know.
When we take up monotheism, don't you have to, whatever services Pharaoh did to Isa Vodazara, his daughter would join him?
I didn't know how involved the girls were in the services. I don't know. So Pharaoh, his sorcerers tell him, you could do a test. Take a bowl, fill it with royal jewels. Take a bowl, fill it with coals. If the child really was going to take the throne from you, then he'll reach for the royal jewels. If the child was just attracted because the crown is shiny, then he'll reach for the coals. So they place these two bowls before him. And Moshe is an intelligent child. He reaches for the jewels. So Gabriel, our angel in heaven, comes down and slaps his hand down onto the coals. Moshe Rabbeinu touches the coals. He burns his hand. And what does he instinctively do? He throws his hand into his mouth with the burning coal and burns his tongue. Burns it very, very badly. And from that day on, Moshe Rabbeinu cannot talk clearly. People can't understand him. He's burnt his tongue. But not just a burn from a hot drink. He's put a burning coal into his mouth. Moshe comes out to Mitzrayim. He runs away from Paro. Paro tries to execute him. God makes a lot of miracles. The executioner, the sword doesn't cut his throat. The guards, one becomes deaf, one becomes dumb, one becomes mute. Each one has a different capacity taken away from them. And Moshe Rabbeinu runs. And David HaMelech learns from Moshe that a believer runs. People sometimes think, if I'm a believer, I have nothing to run for. God's running the world. If I'm supposed to live, I'll live, and I'm supposed to die, I'll die. And David learned from Moshe Rabbeinu, it doesn't work that way. Sometimes if you run, you'll live, and if you don't run, you'll die. So Moshe runs out of harm's way, and David HaMelech learned from him. And he comes to Midian. We don't know how much time he was there. There are all kinds of midrashim about the different wars and the different peoples that he became king over. We once discussed the midrashim about how he became king and he overtook the country which Bilam had taken the throne from. But tonight we don't have time for that. Moshe comes and we have the coin of Midian. Yisro has explored every religion. He was admired as a priest, and then he decided that he's leaving it all. He's going for monotheism. So the people don't like him. What's wrong with you? And when his daughters come to the well, so they give him a hard time. The shepherds start chasing them. And Moshe shows up onto the scene, and he saves the girls. And then he gives their sheep to drink. And Moshe is looking for a shidduch. So what does Moshe do? He does what his grandfathers did. How did Yaakov find his shidduch? By the well. How did Yitzchak's shidduch come along? Through the well. So where's a good place to find the shidduch? By the well. So Moshe comes to the well. When I was dating, I always was wondering, what would be the modern day well? Where should I set up the first date? What? The nightclub? I don't think so. So I didn't think so then. I don't think so now. So they come back home and they tell their father, this Egyptian man saved us. And he also not only saved us from the shepherds, he also gave the sheep to drink. So Yisro tells them, bring him home. Maybe he'll eat some bread. Eat some bread is also a reference to take a wife. Yisro doesn't go out himself to call Moshe in. He sends the girls back and says, all of you, go, invite him back home. When you want your girls to get a shidduch, so you have to do it intelligently, like Yisroel. He says, let him talk to you again. Let him see you again. Go back out there, girls, and you call him home. You call him for the meal. He wants a shidduch. He knows it ain't going to be easy to find the shidduch, because here in Midian, people don't like him, because he's gone against their faith. Chazal tell us, what does it mean, Ish Mitzri, an Egyptian, saved us? Why do they refer to Moshe as an Egyptian? So there's an interesting medrash. The medrash says there's a snake called an arod. An arod is a type of snake that when it bites a person, then there's a race. Whoever hits a body of water first, the other one dies. If the person hits a river or some kind of body before the snake does, the snake drops dead. If the snake hits a body of water before the person drops dead. So there was a man walking and Arod came along and bit him. So he starts running to the nearest river, he comes to the cliff, and the Arod is close behind trying to get to the same river, and he's about to dive into the river, and he sees on his right there's a baby drowning. So he dives in the direction of the baby, he makes it to the river first, the Arod drops dead, and he saves the baby, and he comes out of the river, and the baby's mother says, thank you, mister, thank you, you saved my baby. And the person says, no, you see up there, there's a dead arod. Thank the arod, don't thank me, it's because of him I got here. So Chazal says, same thing happened with Moshe Rabbeinu and the daughters of Yisroel. Moshe Rabbeinu came along and saved them, and they say, thank you, mister. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, don't thank me, thank the Egyptian I killed. It's because of him that I had to come out here to Midian territory. So the question is, what's this medrash teaching us? What's the concept behind this medrash? So Rav Rom, is a rabbi in Harnof, he pointed out to me that maybe the idea of the medrash is that we have to know that even in the bad, there's also potential for good to come out. And you look at the Egyptian beating the Jew, Moshe has to intervene, he has to kill the Egyptian, save the Jew, Moshe has to run out to Midian. It looks pretty bad. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, no, you have to know that this good is also an outgrowth of that bad. We have to know how to recognize that even when things that are difficult happen, so when good comes out of it, we have to know to attribute the good to that bad. We had here in the neighborhood, a few houses from the Machon, a woman who was deathly ill a few years ago. She passed away. And there were a lot of people who came to help the family. So among the people that came to help the family, two shidduchim came out of that. Two or three. So when she was lying on her deathbed, she said to me, look, I know this is the direction God's setting it up, but maybe God wanted a few people to get married on the way, so we have to see if we can't get a few more shidduchim before I go. So it's perspective. One, two for sure happened in her lifetime. And the third, I don't remember. I don't think the third happened in her lifetime. What? The first khatuna happened in her lifetime. The second one I don't remember, and the third one I don't remember. One of the weddings happened in her lifetime, yeah. She couldn't make it, yes. So Moshe becomes the shepherd for Yisroel. And Yisroel makes him promise that he won't leave Midian without his permission. Why does Yisroel do that? Because the tendency of a person is to go back home. As I'll say, a branch falls next to its own tree. A person always has the tendency to go back to his roots. So that's a weakness. We all have to recognize that weakness. When I was dating, so I wanted to date a certain girl, and I agreed, and the girl's parents called up their rabbi, and the rabbi said, I don't know, the guy comes from America, and his family's from America, and you guys live here in Israel. Why would you want to marry a guy like that? His family's all in America. Who knows where he'll end up? So he was right. That's this Rashi. Yisro, when he takes Moshe in, he says, you want to marry my daughter? Promise me you ain't going to leave Midian without my permission. Moshe promises. But what can we do? God tells him, go back to Mitzrayim. Technically, Moshe doesn't have to keep his promise. God just told him to do something. But Moshe wants to make a Kiddush Hashem and not a Chilul Hashem. So he asks permission. He asks God, let me go back home and ask my father-in-law permission. Chazal tell us that when Yisro made Moshe promise, so Yisro had it out with Moshe. Yisro said to Moshe, you know, me and you, we went different paths in life. You began as a monotheist. Your parents were monotheists. You were brought up by a monotheist. I spent my life searching and finally I came to this conclusion. When you educate the children, you have to give them the freedom to explore. Let them see what's wrong in the world and from that let them discover what's right. And Moshe Rabbeinu said, no, it's not the way you go. When you educate children, you got to set them on the right path. You don't let a child mess with fire or mess with other things that'll burn him. You don't let him mess with himself spiritually either. You got to set a kid right. Yisrael said, well, if you want to marry Tzipora, you have to promise me that one kid you'll experiment and do my way. Moshe Rabbeinu agreed. Chazal tell us he erred. And that's why, even though his children really were good, God-fearing Jews, there was an element where the education of that child was off. It wasn't 100%, and that's why Moshe's own grandson, Yonasan ben Gershom ben Moshe, he was an idol worshiper. Chazal say that all stems back to Moshe's having given in this argument. What? I don't know. Maybe he shouldn't have given in on the bargain. I don't know. Yisro makes him promise. Moshe doesn't want a promise. He's going to leave all his people behind. So we have to learn from Moshe that sometimes you have to give in on certain points in the Shidduch. You're never going to find something that's 100%. The question is, which points do you give in and which you don't? That's always the trick in life. What's the balance? But the fact that Yisro makes him promise, you won't leave without my agreeing to it, you won't just disappear on me, that's okay. He gave in on that. Yisro marries the daughter of a priest. And he has two advantages by marrying her. One is, the priests were free from Paro's rule. So he knows that this man doesn't have to worry so much about Paro. He's his own boss. And he also marries the daughter of a priest who happens to have six other girls to marry off. A guy who has seven girls to marry off and they're all big enough that they're going out with the sheep, he's got problems. So Moshe knew they're desperate for a shidduch. They won't check into my family too much. The pasuk says, "Ulchohen Midian sheva banot, vatavona vatidlena." Seems to indicate they came, but you're right; it doesn't say it. But that's what the pasuk seems to say. Moshe is watching the sheep, and he goes deep into the desert to some oasis, so that the sheep will have what to eat, and he's going to have his first vision of prophecy. And it evolves. Rabbeinu Bechaye in the name of Rav Dan says it. But fine. Yes. Moshe is a shepherd, just like the forefathers were shepherds. This way they'd have their own private time in a place where there's good air. And they could move forward in the service of Hashem. And also, being a shepherd is a task that demands of a person to be merciful, to take care of the sheep. So this had the nature, on the one hand, it developed their trait of rachmanut. On the other hand, it gave them the potential to have time to delve into the depths of understanding that God is running the world. Moshe was just looking for a good good grazing ground, and God made it that he had Kfitzas HaDerech, and before he knew it, he finds himself out at Mount Sinai. And the vision of prophecy begins on one level. An angel appears and he sees a vision. There was no bush, there was no fire. There was a vision of prophecy. His neshama sees an angel as a fire. Fire inside a bush, inside a cactus. And this was a special cactus that was built with all the thorns growing inwardly. And it was built like a round cactus and all the thorns went down. Now, what happened was, if you try to stick your hand into this cactus, no problem. It would glide by all the thorns. But when you try to take it out, the thorns would grab one's hands. He wouldn't be able to take it out without cutting up his hands. And this was a reference, this vision of prophecy, to what had happened in Egypt. The Jews wanted to come down into Egypt, no problem. But now when they want to come out, suddenly it's like this thorn bush that all the thorns are pointing downward and it's not easy coming out. And then the pasuk tells us in Elohim called to him, and then it says, Vayomer Hashem, Hashem said, this is an involvement in the vision of prophecy. So Moshe is called, and the first thing he hears is his father's voice. Moshe, Moshe, God doesn't want to scare him. And Moshe says, I'm here. He thinks it's his father talking. Where's his father? And then God tells him, no, I am Hashem, the God of your father, the God of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So Moshe gets a very nice surprise. Oh, my father is one of the patriarchs too? That you're saying the God of my father and the God of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? And then God explains to him, no, it's not like that. Whenever God talks to someone, he begins with small talk. Moshe, Moshe. He begins with, good morning, how are you? We have to learn from Hashem. That's Derech Eretz. Very often when we meet someone, we know what we want from that person. So the conversation begins with, hi, do you have the file we discussed yesterday? Did you get my email? Do you have time for a meeting tonight? Wait a second. Good afternoon. How are you? And if we're a little bit bigger than that, then we could begin by remembering what's important to this person, not only to ourselves. So God begins with small talk. God begins first by calling Moshe's name. And then God tells him, take your shoes off. You're standing in a holy place. I am the God of your father, the God of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And Moshe hides his face. He's scared from looking. When we're offered greatness, all too often we're very eager to run forward. Even great people, when they're offered greatness, are eager to run forward. A really great person hides his face. Shaul, when he's offered the throne, he goes and hides. God tells Moshe, Ro'o Ra'isi, seen I have seen the affliction of my nation in Egypt. I have seen that they will get the Torah. I have seen that they will sin with the eagle. Seen? Yes, I have seen. I know their suffering, and nonetheless, I will maintain my covenant with the forefathers, and I have great anger against the nation that's afflicting them. There's always this dual nature. On the one hand, God says, I'm upset at the enemy, and on the other hand, I'll maintain your zchus, the zchus of the Jewish people, or the zchut avot, or leman shmo, for the sake of God's name. Seems like we don't live up to par. We're supposed to, but we don't. So God tells him, I've come down to save the Jewish people from Egypt, to bring them to the land flowing with milk and honey, that land where the Canaan, Hittite, Amori, Perizzi, Hivi, Yebusi live. So go, I want to send you to Paro, take the Jewish people out. Moshe says, you know, I don't speak clearly. Everyone looks down at me. He's a great king. I'll take the Jews and bring them up against all these great nations. The Jews are wise people. They're not going to listen to me. Even if I take them out of Egypt, when I tell them we have to go to the land of Israel and fight those wars, they're not going to want to come with me to fight those wars. What kind of leader am I? You promised the Jewish people, Anochi ered imicha mitzrayma, I will take you down to Egypt and I will take you out of Egypt. You made that promise, God. So what are you sending me for? You promised you're going to take them out. I'm going to take your place. God tells him, wait, I'm with you. I'm also coming. I'll take them out. I'm with you. I'm not telling you to go at the expense of my going. And this that you've seen, the fire that couldn't consume the bush, is the sign that even though Paro's the greatest king of this time, and you're looked down at, you're a fugitive, you can't talk clearly, he won't be able to touch you. Just like the fire can't touch the bush. The fire is burning and it doesn't consume it. Think about it. Moshe Rabbeinu walks in and Paro doesn't kill him. Why doesn't he kill him on the spot? He knows who Moshe is. He knows Moshe ran out of Egypt when he was deserving of the death penalty. So there are all kinds of midrashim that when Moshe Rabbeinu came in before Paro, Paro had lions there and Paro had dogs there and Paro had all kinds of vicious creatures that would usually attack anyone who dared come before the king unless he had a right to come in, and no one could touch Moshe. When Moshe and Aaron walked in, everyone became tame like puppy dogs. There are midrashim about that. But Chazal say God was telling him, firstly, this is the sign. He's not going to touch you. You were scared they won't believe you to go and fight the Jewish people. Don't worry. They will believe you, because when I take you out of Mitzrayim, you're not going straight to the land of Israel. You're going to come back right here, back to this place, Mount Sinai. And here they will receive the Torah and have a vision of prophecy themselves. And after that vision of prophecy, they will recognize that you are the prophet and the king of the Jewish people. You're right. Just because you're taking them out of Egypt, that's not going to be enough. They wouldn't follow you to the land of Israel if it were just the fact that you took them out of Egypt. But there's going to be something that happens first. I'm going to bring you back here to give them the Torah. And after that, they'll be ready to follow you into the land of Israel. Moshe Rabbeinu asks God, they'll tell me, what's your name? What should I tell them? So God gives them the secret name. And God promises him they will accept the proof. What's Moshe's claim? Why should they believe that you sent me as a prophet to them? This is the first time such thing happens in world history. Every other prophecy, the prophet got prophecy for himself. Now you're telling me to go tell them that you sent me to tell them. Well, then why don't you tell them? This concept that you send someone else to tell them, it's a new concept. Why should they believe that? So that's why God gives them signs. That's why Moshe is called Adon Kol Anvim, the master of all prophets. Moshe initiated this concept. What? Where is he called Adon Kol Anvim? In Chazal, he's definitely called Adon Kol Anvim. What? Trying to think if there's an earlier source. I assume when you ask me, you want the earlier source. I don't remember. Yeah. So? Moshe, yeah. 31 years earlier. No. 31 years earlier. A man by the name of Nun, from the tribe of Ephraim, they were aristocrats. They didn't like the fact that the Egyptians were telling them what to do. They were grandchildren of Yosef. So this man called Nun sat down and did the math. And he said, it's been 400 years from the time of the prophecy of Bris Ben Absarim. Time's up, time to leave. He gathered his tribe together, the tribe of Ephraim, and the rest of the Jews didn't go with him. They tried to leave, and they were all killed. Their bones were left in the valley of Dura. Their bones were the ones that the Navi Yechezkel saw in his vision of prophecy. So now when Moshe Rabbeinu comes, the Jews have seen that there has been a false Messiah. 31 years earlier, someone came along and said, it's time to go, and they all got killed. So now they ask him, what's the sign? And Moshe Rabbeinu gives them the secret code. He says, God said, Pakod Pakanti. Double terminology. Redeem, I have redeemed you. Remember, I have remembered you. And they took that code to Serach Bas Asher. Sarach Bas Asher said, if that's what he's saying, he's for real. Sarach Bas Asher had said initially, don't go with Nun, the son of Ephraim, and now she said he's for real. Moshe Rabbeinu says, they won't believe me that you've appeared to me with the great name of mercy. Because in essence, what I'm telling them is that you've revealed to me more than you've revealed to the Avos. They have on tradition how you appeared to the forefathers. The way you've appeared to me now is bigger than the way you appeared to the forefathers. You're telling me you're going to take them out b'midat rachamim, with great compassion. That's not what you told the forefathers. And Moshe thought they would claim, if it were really like you're saying, then we wouldn't have a problem with Paro. God told us that Paro is going to make it difficult. He's not going to let you out. And it's going to take time. If really God's going to take us out the way you say, out of His own compassion, then it should happen right away. God tells them, you keep saying they're not going to believe. They will believe. You won't believe. Ultimately, you'll see. Chazal say Moshe went too far. God tells him, take your staff, throw it on the ground. Moshe throws it on the ground, and the staff turns into a snake. Now, this was a special staff. This was a staff that was in the Garden of Eden. Adam HaRishon had it, and it was created on the eve of Shabbos, of creation. Adam HaRishon found it in the Garden of Eden. He gave it over to Chanoch. Chanoch gave it over to Noach. Noach gave it to Avram. Avram to Yitzchak. Yitzchak to Yaakov. Yaakov brought it down to Egypt and gave it to Yosef. And when Yosef died, Paro took everything Yosef owned, everything out of his house. Yisro was one of the great sorcerers in Mitzrayim. He saw that staff, and he took it and brought it to his house. And when Moshe married Yisro's daughter, he recognized the staff and he took it. And he knew this was the staff that would be an integral part of redemption. On the staff was inscribed Titzach Adash Be'achav, corresponding to Dantzer De'akinim Arov De'ver Shechin, Parad Ar Bechoshech Bechoros, the 10 plagues. So Moshe throws the staff down and it turns into some kind of huge snake. And God tells him, grab it. And Moshe grabs it and it turns back into the staff. Now, the concept was that just like God punished the first Paro who abducted Sarah, who abducted Sarah Imenu, so too God was going to punish this Paro. And just like Moshe took hold of him, so too he was going to be in control of Paro. And the snake corresponded to the ancient snake, this huge snake that had feet and could talk back in the time of the Garden of Eden. And that snake was really the Tsar of Paro. And when Moshe Rabbeinu sees that the angel of Paros has such strength down here on earth below, he sees this huge snake before him, and he recognizes what this represents spiritually, that he was given great strength here on earth. So Moshe Rabbeinu runs. He's scared of this concept that Paro has been given such forces down here. And God tells him, no, don't fear. Grab the tail, and you're going to control Paro. Paro kept claiming, I control the Nile. And that's why God told him, take water from the Nile and you'll turn it into blood. And that's a sign, that's an allusion to the fact that you're going to make plagues together with the Nile. You'll be in control of the Nile. Aaron is coming out to greet you. Moshe has been arguing back and forth because until now Aaron's been the leader, and God tells him, don't worry, he'll be happy and he'll join you in leading the Jewish people. Just like the redemption from Egypt was done by Moshe and Aaron as partners, so too in the future the redemption will be done by partners, the Mashiach together with Elio. Hashem should send them swiftly. We are out of time for tonight. Bezat Hashem, tomorrow night, if we have time, we will try to do a little bit more on the end of the parasha.